Yeah, this is Drinking Wine Talking Tech. I'm Jonathan Reichenthal.
And I'm Tom O'Malley.
You know what? This is our 9th episode.
Has it been that long?
It has.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised we lasted this long.
I'm surprised our listeners have lasted this long.
And there's more and more, which is fantastic.
Is Japan still strong?
Japan is our second biggest audience after the United States.
Domo arigato gozaimasu.
That's very kind of you to do that. Yeah. And the UK is our third.
All right.
How about that?
That's lovely.
And then it drops off considerably after that.
Yeah.
Our biggest episode so far, by a long shot, was the final episode of season one, which is our data show. Does that surprise you?
You know, it doesn't. I tell you why. It was our final episode, and then we had a gap.
Yeah.
And people were craving the smooth, sultry sound of Jonathan. And so they just kept coming back to season six, episode six.
Yeah.
So I think that's due to the gap. I think if we continued with more episodes.
Or more gaps.
Or maybe we should have more gaps. Good point.
I wanted to remind our listeners, too, that we are on Facebook.
Yeah, and we're also live. So the phones are open, folks. Call in whenever you like. I'll give you Jonathan's number.
Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, dial in. That's great. Phone lines are open.
That's right.
So facebook.com/drinkingwinetalkingtech.
That'll probably work better.
Yeah. That'll work.
Yeah. Have people been using it?
A little bit. Okay. Yeah. We get.
But they still go to your Twitter handle a lot, too.
Well, that's true.
Has anyone said, hey, Jonathan, I need you to pass this message on to Tom?
They've not used it for that yet.
Okay.
Are we expecting something?
No, I'm just kind of hoping that one day you're going to say, hey, you've got a particular fan, some fan mail here.
That'll come. That'll come. Right. One of the things we're following right now in real time is your startup. And
that and the Bitcoin price, yeah.
Yeah. To the extent you can actually share.
So if you recall, we had a term sheet, right?
Yeah.
And then, but it wasn't the complete round. So I needed to go out and fill the round. And then we found that raising a small check in this town is a lot harder than raising a big one. Nah. So we had to expand the round in order to fill it.
Right.
And so now we've got two parties on the term sheet, and it's set to close on December 22nd. But it's never without its drama. It's filled with learnings, opportunities to learn around every corner. And what's funny is, you know, I'm 44, right?
Okay.
But a lot of the folks that have been at this for years, obviously they have much more experience at it. And so I feel like a kid again.
Oh wow!
You know, and I truly am learning a ton, probably at the cost of my own valuation, my own dilution, and but you know, I don't see another way. I think it's just a process that you got to get through. And I think the assurance that I get from other entrepreneurs is, it's this difficult for everybody. So if it hurts, you're probably doing it right.
Right.
Which I think describes learning and innovation, for that matter. If it, you know, it's you're not going to do anything impactful if it doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's where it's at. So hopefully, in our next couple episodes, I'll be able to give you more updates and hopefully have a bank account slip with me to prove that we've actually accomplished something.
So today's a little unusual too. We don't have any wine in front of us. This is drinking water, talking tech today, right?
Mine's not water. Now it is.
And one of the reasons is because we're in the afternoon, and we did that to accommodate our tremendous guest who we have with us today
and his tremendous schedule.
So we're kind of starstruck. We have Scott McNeely here today.
Try not to show it.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for the opportunity to be on this very famous show.
All five of our listeners are going to be thrilled to hear from you.
You know, Scott's always been an early mover in things, and for him to attend our show is just testimony to that. He sees potential, and in a way, he's taken a long position in it. So I really appreciate that, Scott.
I'm all in.
Thanks.
I'll be looking for my stock options soon.
That's right. We should incorporate the show at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once we have, you know, repeat listeners.
Well, we think we could get sponsorship from wine companies, possibly Northern California.
Yeah.
Because we like talking about wine and drinking good wine.
Or maybe even tech companies that want us to talk about their tech.
Oh, sponsorship.
They'll probably pay us not to talk about their tech.
That's right. Please don't.
Yeah.
That's great. So, Scott, it's amazing to have you here. We're just absolutely thrilled. When we had Gil on, you know, some people are just so well known that you don't almost have to go into their resume.
I know, I never get an introduction.
Yeah.
Formerly famous and important, Scott McNeely. You want to do that
one? I think that will suffice. I think we'll use that. No, you certainly are a luminary of Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is the way it is today, partially because the great work you did in building it to what it is today. You were the CEO of Sun Microsystems. I think that's what you're most famous for. And again, it's great to have you here. And we're not going to talk about Sun today. We're going to talk about some of the stuff you're doing currently.
I think it's worth mentioning, though, that there's not a lot of tech CEOs that were in their role for the span that Scott was. You were there for, I'm guessing, over 20 years. And you were the original founder of that company.
One of the co-founders, yes.
And then to take it all the way to an acquisition at Oracle is just phenomenal. Like that story, I can't think of a matching story. So it's worth at least pointing that out to our listeners. This is not somebody who started an app and lived with it for 18 months before they got booted.
Or exited. I could have gotten exited earlier. Now there's been some other great players out there, and you know, you got to put Steve Jobs at the top of the list, and Larry Ellison's been around forever. You look at a guy like Dave Duffield who did PeopleSoft, and then he did Workday. So there are a few guys out there that I look at and think, well, you know, I did okay, but they did great.
Is there a club? Do you guys get together? And is there a secret password?
It's called a Billionaires Club, and I'm not a member of it. I'm not a member of it, but I like to go to the parties and, you know, I do the screw top on the wine and pour the wine for the guys. But it's a pretty interesting club.
What an amazing time in life for you to have witnessed this front row seat to the development and working with those names you just mentioned as well. I mean, what a club to be a part of.
Yeah, you know, I think about that, but, you know, I do want to brag a little bit because there were 235,000 former colleagues of mine at Sun Microsystems, and we're all part of a club that I think is even more fun than the Billionaires Club because we all made a difference. And you look at the things that we drove and invented, TCP/IP. We were the first company to ever ship TCP/IP on every computer we ever shipped. Wow. NFS was the first file sharing thing that took off across the board. This sounds a little Al Gore-ish, but we invented open source, and we can sort of back that up. We were a top 40 R&D spender, where we open sourced as much as 80% of our R&D. We were in front of the open source parade in just about every area you can think about. Amazing. Java, Genie. You think about what we did with Risk and Spark, and what we did with open operating systems with Solaris and virtualization, and you know, the network is the computer, and you know, all of those things that we did. I mean, Twitter is written entirely in Java.
That's right.
Not entirely, but I mean, it's basically written in Java.
And pretty much every enterprise app is written in Java.
Or it ought to be if you don't want viruses and you want scalability and reliability and all the rest of it. Gotcha. So, you know, it's been, that's what's really a kick. It wasn't, you know, making money or whatever, although having employees come to me and say, you know, I put my kids through college or I bought a house or, you know, I took care of my parents or whatever, that's really powerful and psychic income. But just watching all the kids now in the .com era thinking, you know, toothpaste.com is where it's really at, you know, when none of this would have happened without the predecessors before me, which were all the physics and chemistry and silicon guys from Fairchild and from National Semiconductor in the early days of Intel, all the rest of it, you know. And then the next wave came through the systems guys, which was Bill Gates and Larry Ellison and myself and John Chambers. And we were, you know, there was the Four Horsemen. I'm trying to remember who the other. And then, you know,
I think it was Johnny Cash.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So, you know, it was a fun time. It was interesting. And I liked it because the Valley was building things back then.
Yeah. It's kind of like you said, it's almost like laying infrastructure.
It was. It was foundational enabling technology.
Right.
And, you know, it turned into magic when we took the Java virtual machine for free and put it with the Netscape browser for free.
Yeah.
That changed everything faster than any single event I can think of in computing, because now you had executable content out on the web.
So who came up with that dial-in noise that we don't get to hear anymore?
I don't know. I don't miss it, though.
That was a tremendous biography, actually, that sharing that and useful to me, too. I wanted to kind of talk to one thing you said, this sort of family of 250,000 people that are all in some way ex-Sun people or currently Sun people. I get to meet these people. They're maybe running startups now, or they're part of enterprises. They have always the best things to say about the culture you built. There needs to be more of that today, it seems.
Yeah, I don't know. It seemed obvious. We kicked butt. We had fun. We were open. We shared. You know, these were just all part of the ethos that we had there.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah, it's a great point to make there, Jonathan. I think, laying out a business strategy is in hindsight, it's the easiest part. What I'm finding is a young CEO, and we've heard, I think it was Drucker that said it, culture eats strategy for breakfast. Mm-hmm. And it's just so true every day. My challenges or my successes are determined by strategy or by culture over strategy.
Yeah.
So to build a sustaining culture for 20 some odd years is my hat's off to you for sure.
Thanks. It's you got to learn that you have lots of strengths and be comfortable with them, but you have lots of blind spots and cover for them, and that's the harder part that a lot of folks don't do. And the other thing I always figured out, if I went into the room with my staff and I wasn't the dumbest guy in the room, I had done a bad job building my staff. And if I could solve the problems for them, I figured I didn't have the right person there. So it's sort of, I guess I just became, comfortable being around people smarter than me and very uncomfortable around people who weren't as smart as me.
Yeah.
And I think that's a sort of a managerial courage thing that allows you to have a culture of participation, yet not consensus, of, delegation, of, leading, not managing.
Yeah.
Those were some of the, hallmarks of our
It's shop. Opposite of what people think. They think of the CEO calling all the shots. It can be an incredibly humbling position to be in. Mm-hmm. Right.
There's only one, everybody wants to be Steve Jobs, but there's only one Steve Jobs. The guy was a freak genius.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I liked working for him.
Yeah.
It might have been a little uncomfortable and fun in places, but he was so freaky smart. He was so, he had a little magic. There is no magical CEO cocktail, genetic cocktail or characteristics cocktail, but you got to get the right level of the right things, and it's almost accidental how it works and who works. But I'll tell you what, Larry's different from me. I'm different from Bill Gates.
Yeah.
Bill Gates is different from Steve Jobs, and
there's lots of ways to do it.
Different from all of us. Right. It's fascinating to see. People like to write books. The 20 keys to great CEO leadership.
Right,
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Steve Jobs doesn't fit any of them.
Yeah. Have you ever written a book?
No.
Have you been asked to?
I've a ton of times.
Yeah.
There was a book written on Sun. I never read it because I lived it. And I started reading it and I went, bullshit. I was there.
Oh, gotcha.
Can I say that on air?
Yeah. You can.
Okay.
You can say it twice if you like.
I'll get it. My wife will get all over me.
I'll clean it up.
Yeah. All right.
I worked for Larry for about 7 years up until I left to do this startup.
Genius.
He's off the charts.
He's off the charts.
Yeah. I was a couple rungs away from him, but I felt the ripples of the genius every
safe.
Day.
Safe. Yeah. That's a safe place to be. At least a few. Right.
Yeah. It was good though.
We could end the podcast right now and we would have delivered more insight up to this point than all our previous podcasts
episode
put
one.
Together.
Yeah.
Now, you left Sun in 2010, and it was acquired by Oracle. You could have just played golf, which you love, I understand, and your children are awesome at it. But you didn't. Maybe tell us what you've been up to since then.
Well, so when I left, when I stepped down as CEO, it was 5 years before Oracle bought us. My boys were 2, 4, 6, and 8. And my dad was a great executive, but he worked really, really hard, and he saw one of my sporting events, one hockey game out of all the golf, hockey, tennis, swimming, sailing, other things that I did. And I said, I wanna sort of be selfish and be with my boys and help raise those four little startups and not leave my wife with four boys at home while I'm traveling around to Asia and Europe and all the rest of it. So I stepped down. I did ask. So I did some consulting and started some companies and stuff over the next 5 years. And then when Oracle bought us, I asked Larry if he would give me, because of all of the things that we predicted and created and invested in, all of them are still going on. But the one that I wanted to go do is I asked them for the Sunray Thin Client technology, the Open Office, Star Office franchise, and I think the user interface for that, because I wanted to build thin clients. The one thing that still sticks in my craw is how crazy it is that we carry little personal mainframes with state, with storage, with CPUs, with all this other stuff, when all you need is a keyboard, a microphone, a speaker, and a camera connected to a radio with a display of the size you need, nearly infinite battery life, total safety of your desktop, which is running in the cloud. And we had that running, and we were pushing it, but when Oracle bought us, they weren't into open source, and they certainly weren't into so I asked Larry if I could just take that and do was it NetSuite was the company he started with Zach Nelson, which he owned half of, and I think he eventually bought it back. But I said, do that, you can have half the company, give me the startup money, and I'll go create Thin Client, and we'll go take on Intel Microsoft PCs and the Apple PCs. And he said no. So I was a little disappointed. I wish he'd done that, and I would have probably still be I'd probably still be working, but at some point, that's the one area I think that has got to happen at some point, so that we stop worrying about whether we've lost our iPad or not.
Yeah. Well, if it helps, we could always roll up to that billionaires club we were talking about earlier. Let the air out of his tires. He'll never know it. It's you. I'll cover for you as well.
Let me tell you, you don't want to get near Larry's car. He's got serious protection.
I bet.
Good bit of advice there, I think.
So anyhow, I basically have spent the time, started weighin.com, which is changing advertising. I've been continuing with my give back, which is kariki.org, which is changing education. I've been raising my four boys. I've got one out, two at college, and one who just committed to going to college in Texas. And then I've been doing advisory work, and I was doing free advisory work, and I found out that free has infinite demand. So now I just say, give me stock options. And if you don't like what I'm doing, take the options away. But I'm not an employee, and I just advise companies, and the ones that get successful, I tend to spend more time on because the stock options are more valuable, and I have no other way to value
more fun.
My
there's
time.
More to do.
There's more leverage to my time because I can leverage a larger shareholder value. So I'm sort of using economics to decide where I spend my time. I've got 5,200 emails in my stack right now, maybe 5,300 after this. And I just pick and choose and work on the things where I think I can add value and provide insight. You guys sent me a note, and I said, this will be fun. I'll do that.
Why education? Why focus there?
I had four boys, and my third grader, my oldest was a third grader, and he was spending $130 on a third grade math textbook. And it was gratuitously revised when 10 plus 10 was, is, and will be 20 forever. And they were carrying a backpack, a crushing backpack, and a roller bag
around
all this stuff. And, and then I did some research, and I thought, this is crazy. We're spending up to $15 billion a year on K-12 curriculum, and nothing's changed since Newton got hit on the head with an apple. So why are we doing this? And why aren't we doing the flipped classroom where everything's on the iPad and you go into school after doing all your lectures on your iPad, you go in and get tech support from the teacher at school? Well, the problem is all teachers want to be, they want to be, the great Saul Kahn lecturer. When we had 40,000 piano players back in the silent movie era, and so you'd go in there and they'd be playing during the movie. But you either got a drunk one, a bad one, or a good one, but you never got the best one. Now you can put the best curriculum lectures and ideas on the net, and everybody can get access to them. We have, with the technology, we now have two really great piano players in Los Angeles, and everybody gets good music on their movies. And I want to drive that strategy, but we still need tech support when people get stuck. And I want to have push-to-talk and push-to-talk for free and push-to-talk for fee so that kids can go self-paced. I think the gamification of education is the holy grail. And every kid wants a leaderboard and a scoreboard.
They love it.
And they want instant feedback on whether they got it right or wrong.
Right.
Have you ever seen anybody read a textbook or watch a lecture and stand up and go, yes, I did it. I got it. Bing, bing, bing. I'm in the super zone.
My kids do that with the iPad. Level
48, right? Yep. But, it's so bad that we haven't moved education that way. And I believe it's because we have given a monopolist the one of the most treasured things we can do, and that's educating our children.
Yeah.
And a monopolist will be corrupt. It will be expensive. It will lack total innovation, and it will just stay where it is.
Yeah.
And just siphon money off for other things. And I think that's what's happened with government education. And I know a lot of people disagree with me, but I think the private sector with choice, innovation, and just moving to vouchers alone would allow people. But I thought, why are we spending money on curriculum? It should all be open source. We open source operating systems, yeah, spreadsheets, applications, and even microprocessor instruction sets. So with Curriki, we have now amassed 250,000 plus learning assets on one site, all free, all open. And we have 10 plus 12 million visitors. We have, we get to a couple hundred million students through this environment. My goal is to take this Lego bucket of 250,000. We've got worksheets, science projects, textbooks, lectures, videos, everything you can imagine in the curriculum space, and assemble it into Legoland. And Legoland is a free, online, self-paced, real-time scored, internationalized, localized, multimedia, web-enabled, certified K-12 experience, so that every child can go. Instead of nobody held back, I want every parent, teacher, We have no kid left behind. I don't want to have any teacher, parent, or student held back. And I guarantee you, 90% of the listeners, maybe 100% with this group, because it's probably 100%, all of you could have finished high school by the age of 12 or 13 had you had self-paced, real-time scored, and a push to talk to somebody if you got stuck.
Yeah. And the evidence is such, my 10-year-old, she's smarter than I am.
Yes.
Already. And much more capable in many things.
My high schoolers, all four of my boys at the end of high school, knew way more than I knew after Harvard and Stanford.
Right.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. Way more.
Yeah.
And so, just getting the teacher out of the way, letting the kid go hard, and let him go, because each kid is like a fingerprint. Some like math, some right. like languages, some right. like history, some like, they all like, and let him shoot for the stars. On that, but telling you got to do a minimum level at each of the areas.
Right, get some exposure, but yeah.
And if you score it, it's like a video game to them. Mm-hmm. And, all of the self-paced classes that my boys did, at 10 o'clock, we'd go into the study. We had four of them in a little study together. And we'd say, all right, step away from the computer right now. I'm going to pull the plug on it if you don't go to bed now. Because they would they loved it. They could go at their own pace and they could go at rocket speed. So I think homeschooling is the great new self-paced holy grail. And then you go to, and by the way, they come to me with, my son came to me and said, Dad, the class is stuck on orbitals in chemistry. I go, orbitals, great. I thought that was astronomy. He says, 3 days, the teacher can't teach it. I says, well, go to Cricky and search on orbitals. He came back, saw a Sol Khan video in 5 minutes, said, I got it, Dad. I've called four guys. I've taught the class orbitals now. We're moving on. Tomorrow we can move on to the next stage. It's that kind of. It should just be there for
Isn't
them.
That something? Yeah.
So we're going to put your URL, curriki.org, on Facebook, and we want people to visit it and explore it.
Donate, too, because I want to keep it free. Everybody, right. With the growth rates on this thing, this would be an unbelievably successful .com. But I want it to be free because, you know what? All the money's being siphoned off to the government sector, and I want to keep it free because the teachers are using this for supplemental materials. The kids are using it to get ahead.
Right.
Parents are using it to homeschool. I want it to be free, so we're taking donations.
Good. Well, I'm glad we could plug that.
Thank you.
Tremendous. I just came back from Singapore. I was there for a few days, actually doing a little teaching myself. And if you've been there, you know that it's a pretty remarkable place, very modern, really smart people, highly educated. I come back and your team sent me some information on education in advance of this conversation. Turns out Singapore by far is has the best schools, best education in the world now. Looked for the U.S. We're not very high on that list. Your thoughts?
Oh, my God. I'm going to get in trouble for this one. I don't know that it's the schools.
Okay.
I have this theory that the schools are making my kids' IQ better. It's my brilliant wife who made my kids' IQ better. And, you know, that a lot of it is inherited talent. I'm just not a believer that Harvard made me higher IQ. It gave me some data points that I didn't have and maybe helped me learn some tricks, but I learned them at the rate I learned them because of inherent generic IQ.
And were decided so early on. Number of words spoke to you. I think you brought this up on an earlier episode, right, where you could draw a correlation between IQ and the actual number of words a baby, an infant, was hearing and interacting and interfacing with, particularly, right, to your point, with the mother.
Right.
Is that what you're getting at?
Well, yeah, but I think, I don't know whether it's the mother saying the words or the kids hearing the words and therefore the mother responding more. But, you know, we all want to have this fantasy that we can take somebody who, listen, I'm not Steve Jobs. I am not Bill Joy, or I am not Andreas Bechtolsheim. These people are wicked smart. Life's not fair, and it wasn't because they went to good schools.
Yeah.
They were wicked smart. They were born wicked smart. And so my big beef with calling schools great, you know, I worry that in the evolutionary blink of an eye, we've gone from 25 years of average lifespan to 70 or 80 or whatever, and now we're taking these 4 years of 18 to 22, putting people in university, teaching them how to drink, tailgate, how to procreate, how to, you know,
beer bongs, the whole bit.
And by the way, I think they're getting very, very left-leaning education. They're not getting the balance of the two stories. I think the whole 4 years are totally, I mean, universities in the U.S. have become football teams with libraries attached,
right.
when neither are what we need right now. So taking those 4 years, if you think about our genetic and evolutionary makeup, how many great mathematicians, great artists, great athletes, great music, whatever, it's they in the 18 to 22 year, that's where they're unbelievably creative,
curious,
testosterone, hormoned up, all the rest of it. They got infinite amounts of energy and absolutely no adhesions to the old way we were doing things.
Right.
And I just think it's a huge opportunity cost to put people in. And then if you look at the number of degrees that are absolutely unhireable. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was thinking back of being a CEO and somebody came into me with some of these degrees they have, I go, I got no customer need for somebody with that expertise.
Oh, boy.
So,
And I hear it about employers as well. They're a lot less concerned about what school you went to. They look for that curiosity in your resume. They look for what passion is driving you to learn fast right now. And it's remarkable that, you know, Scott's describing an institution that's becoming less relevant over time while the cost is going the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So it's doomed for disruption.
Well, you're CEO, you know, I mean, and think about if somebody got into Stanford but didn't go, would that stop you from hiring them? No. I mean, Stanford's a great filter for people who are.
Right.
And so I've encouraged all my boys, my first three kids got into Stanford. I said, don't go.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
All three of them went.
Oh, yeah. Listen to that.
It's expensive. Yeah. But, you know, the whole point is Gates, Ballmer, Jobs, Ellis, and I don't know if Allison, I think Allison was Zuckerberg, all these dropouts.
Yeah.
Dropped out and got going.
Because they had died.
I stayed and got my MBA, which is why I'm here talking to you guys instead of.
Well, if it helps, we'll try to get Gates in here.
Yeah,
we will.
Yeah.
So the advice is drop out of university.
That's right. For those of you listening.
What I told my boys is if you want to go to university and play D1 golf.
Right.
Get a STEM degree. Well, I'll fund that. You've earned it. You worked really hard in high school and learned more than I learned in all of my education. And I'll be happy to fund that. But then you're going to go out and get a real job.
Yeah.
So my oldest went out and became a pro golfer. Well, whatever. He's got a management science and engineering degree. Yeah, he's on the web.com. He's a rookie.
Terrific. How old is he?
He's 20. He just turned 22.
Oh, man. Perfect.
2 weeks ago.
Wow.
And he's He's playing in the Web.com finals on Thursday.
You got to be proud. That's great.
No, I'm happy for him. I'll be proud.
You're a little jealous of his swing, I bet.
No, I'll be proud of him when, and I'm very proud of his comportment and the way he handles himself. And yeah. You know, if you go on,
you'll be mentally.
If you
tough,
go,
right?
If you go follow Maverick Duck, Maverick McNeely on Twitter and see some of his interviews, he's way better than me. I mean, the guy is very poised and wonderful. So I'm very proud of all that. But I'll be proud of him when he really adds to the. I'm a capitalist and a private sector kind of advocate, and when he has started contributing to all of that, I mean, entertainers to some degree are, you know, productivity decreasers.
Gotcha.
Because what are you doing while you're watching them?
Right.
Not much. You're not moving the capitalist ball forward. But I'm excited for him, and he has, you know, I've always told the four boys to whom much is given, much is expected.
That's right.
And he's taking that very seriously, and he wants to build a brand, some notoriety, and some assets to go do good things. So he's already, he's not making any money, but he's already working hard. He played in the Shriners, and he worked hard to raise money online for the Shriners Hospital.
But he's competing. He's learning self-poise. He's learning how to handle defeat as well, and these things are part of creating value in the future. So good on him for using his youth in this way. I think that's great.
I will tell you, I've seen a lot of executives. All four of my boys have been sort of raised, you know, kind of like Manning raised all of his to be quarterbacks. Yeah. All of these boys would be wonderful leaders in a technical space because He got his degree and was kind of a big data scientist management science and engineering degree. And my second son is looking at mechanical engineering. My third son is an absolute computer nut and he hurt his hip playing hockey. So he spent the year learning piano and learning Java on his own.
Wow.
And then my fourth son, he wants to go play pro golf. So he's going to Baylor.
So great school.
They're ranked higher than Stanford in golf. So.
Oh, my goodness.
He's going there.
Yeah.
Whatever.
That's tremendous. One of the things we believe why people even listen to us is we call this having sort of a little bit of a front seat on Silicon Valley. Tom and I don't mind talking about the rough edges and what actually happens here. The world is still fascinated with Silicon Valley. So it'd be really cool to get your perspective of where things are today. There's lots of reasons why we're concerned. There's lots of reasons why we're excited. I mean, just wanted to get your perspective.
Well, you know, it's the valley's too big now to say. I mean, it used to be silicon, then it became systems, and then a little spinning rust for disk drives, and then we moved into operating systems, and then some applications, and then it went to toothpaste.com and everything else, and now it's moved into social, and there's a lot of other things. But I had a very interesting chat. I like to ask leaders. So I met with Hennessy, the head of Stanford, once, and I said, give me your thumbnail elevator pitch on where is Stanford. And he said, well, we want to be at the and I thought it was very crisp, precise, and interesting. And I think the Valley could follow this in a positive way. We want to be at the intersection of technology and healthcare. Really pithy, really right on, mm-hmm. very cool, mm-hmm. and a very right on space. And I'd love to see the Valley, you know, get behind that and stay focused on that, because it's all good stuff.
Does that imply you'd like to see the Valley get more profound in the work that they're doing? Move past this era of social and car apps and get into stuff that's.
We didn't let our boys have any social. We didn't let them have any computers or technology in their bedroom. The four of them slept in a room. Right in a row. No electronics.
Like barracks. You were
and we had the passwords to all their stuff, and we wouldn't allow them to use it or bring it to the dinner table. And only when they got in could they get a Facebook app. And we let them have Twitter, but we watch and see who they're following, mm-hmm. so we know mm-hmm. exactly who they're following on their Twitter. So we kept a very large control over that. So, yeah, I think, the socials, I love Twitter. I'm sort of addicted to it.
Is that right?
That's my clipping service. You know, I follow the Wall Street Journal and whatever, and that's where I get my news, and I can follow my sports teams, and I can follow my buddies if they're up to anything. But, Yeah, I think, you know, we need to make sure we're doing stuff. Gaming, I don't know. You know, like, has gaming really moved the ball forward? We everybody says, well, yeah, then we can fly drones in the Defense Department. That's about seven people, right? And you think about the centuries, man centuries of people spending time and, you know, like esports and all the rest of it. But I guess as we move down Maslow's hierarchy, we've got to find some way to occupy people so they don't go out and break things.
That's true. Yeah, and stop them from procreating. So if they're playing a video game instead of out there raising families, maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah. I think if you have a kid, though, you ought to raise it.
Yeah.
And not export it to the schools and to daycare. I'm sorry. I'm a believer that nobody understands your kid better than two biological parents.
Yeah.
And the more you can do that, the better chance you'll have. I believe the role of parenting isn't to make your kids smarter or isn't to, you know, because their IQ is sort of, I think, hardwired. I've got four boys and I know how hardwired, because they slept in the same room, ate the same food, played the same sports, went to the same schools,
very
lived under
people.
The same rules. They're very different people. It's hard freaking wired. There's no... All of these.
You can only break them, is what my wife and I say.
Yeah, right. But what parents can do is put civility and civility, I think, is the right word, and make sure that they're polite. They live in a civil society.
They like themselves. There's a
their law. Esteem, they're law abiding, and they understand rules. I mean, you go to college, and what's the first rule they break? Drinking.
Yeah,
it's a 21 age.
Mine was sniffing glue, but I'm sure most do drinking.
That explains it. So, but, you know, it drives me crazy that, you know, these leading universities that are developing the next leaders of the world say beer pong Tuesday is okay.
Yeah.
They are leading and setting the example for global leaders around the world that laws don't matter, because we set our own rules here inside of the campus, and drinking is facilitated. They say just keep your door open in case you're like throwing up on yourself or something. That's no rule.
Well, it's seen as a fringe benefit, right? It's actually very self-serving of the organization. If we're known as a not a party school, then kids don't want to go there. You know, they want to go to the party school that has that has it all.
I had a buddy said to me, he's my age, and he said, my 4 years at Princeton were the best 4 years of my life. And I thought, I'm so sorry. And
for your parents for paying that.
If that's the best of your life.
Yeah.
But schools do want to make it the best 4 years of your life.
Yeah.
And think about the branding. I'll tell you, every marketeer listening, every tech, look at the branding universities do. Babies are born and they're given a Stanford sweatshirt.
Yeah.
They, you know, they're and the parents running around in their
it's like Disney.
It's more. I mean, you will see more branded big huge logos across the front of their chest, and they will send you notes for the rest of your life, and you're going to leave money to them. You're going to
donate. It's the only product
and you paid
that you'll ever buy.
You overpaid for it to begin with.
You overpaid for it, and then they come back and have the nerve to ask you for more.
Right. I bought a box of Cheerios. Can you send me some more money after you consume it?
Right. You know, never understood it.
It is. They are the most powerful brands in the world.
Yeah.
And I go back to, none of them made you smarter.
Yeah.
Because you were born smart.
It's nostalgia. It's their product.
And so what they do is they put you in a dorm. They have lots of parties. When I took my son over to school, we walk in and there's a table. People are dressed up in wild outfits, and they have recognized my son Colt, and they go, Colty, blah 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 blah. They're screaming and throwing confetti, and this is when he's walking in. It is a total indoctrination to the brand, and they want to make sure you have a really really good time, and that you'll think that everything that happened great to you was because of those 4 years.
Yeah,
personally, I couldn't wait to get out of school.
Yeah, me too.
One of the things we did prior to this podcast, and Tom, I don't think I shared it with you, was I asked on Facebook and Twitter for questions that they would like to ask Scott. And so I sort of summarized in this question a few folks. I wanted to just have a shout out to Rob Lloyd. He's a good buddy of mine. He's a CIO of San Jose. And he took the lead on this question, and I've kind of tweaked it a little bit. It basically was something like this. You know, what kinds of companies are best prepared for transformation?
Mm.
You know, what, do you have some thoughts on that?
New ones. and you know, that's a sad fact.
Yeah.
Also, companies that have huge cash cows. Mm. If you have Windows Office franchise, or if you are like Google and you auction off every word in the dictionary to the highest bidder every day, those are really nice franchise. Mm. If you have my wife as your Amazon customer, that's a franchise that will fund lots of new efforts.
It's runway, yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah. A lot of runway. So the other thing that I think allows companies to move quickly is to be very careful about what you make or buy. I think a CEO's number one tactical job is decide what to make and what to buy. And I always said, if the customer cares about this employee, and when they come in to visit us or they think about our product, they're thinking, wow, they probably have some really good people doing this inside their company. Those are the kinds of things that you make. The stuff that they don't care about, like nobody ever came into our offices and said, you know, who's the security guard out front, or mm-hmm. who is flipping the burgers in back, you know, or whatever. Those are jobs that, you know, a chef has a much higher ceiling at a food company than they do at a computer company. You owe it to them to get them in a food company. So make mm-hmm. versus buy is a huge, and I think if you've done a great job of keeping your payroll down mm-hmm. by just having people that matter to your customers, it gives you a heck of a lot more margin and a heck of a lot more flexibility to, because the world will change above, below, and around you faster than you ever believed at every company now going forward. That's a rule.
And so what's sort of embedded in that, so if you take that to a lot of trends that we're seeing on the web, if your advice is stay core, hire your core, and then there's so many options now of what you can do with the non-core, right? You can rent it by the day, by the hour, right, by the month. The answer isn't necessarily go hire Accenture. Exactly. There's so many creative ways to get those insights into your business.
So the one warning I would give companies, mm-hmm. and I've been saying this for a long, long time, the world's moving from list price to a listing, and it's going to bid ask, and it's going online. And what that says is the life of a broker is very precarious and short term.
Right.
Brokers, you have to understand what a broker does. They, you know, a house broker says to somebody, this is a great price for the house. You'll never find this much house for that price. And then they go to the seller and they go, you'll never find anybody crazy enough to buy this.
Right.
So they're playing liar yeah. out of both sides of their mouth. And at some point, you know, technology allows the buyer and seller to get together and make that decision without paying a 6% fee.
To increase the BATNA, Jonathan, that's the MBA term. The area of negotiation.
Ah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought I'd throw that in there.
I just come here to learn stuff. That's cool. Is that right?
That's what I got out of my $210,000 in my MBA.
So what's I think the most fascinating new technology that I see coming along that really targets brokers is this whole concept of blockchain with an online, open, trusted ledger out there that allows you to. Now, the people who are going to make all of this happen, I think, are the ones who can take the 10-minute resolution time down to seconds and can take the dollar per transaction down to less than a penny.
And we're seeing a ton of innovation in that
and
space
it's,
right now.
It's going to, I mean, think about at Sun, I don't need Wall Street, I don't need fairness opinions, I don't need investment bankers and all the rest of it. My stock, every certificate I have has a complete online visible auditable ledger for who owns it and when and where and how. You know, you can plow Manhattan right into the Atlantic and make golf courses out of the entire island, and the world would be better.
Yeah, it's the number one thing that people are trying to discover on our platform today. So whereas about a year ago it was all IoT, and then it's all blockchain now, and people are looking at it from anti-counterfeit for product serialization, inventorying, supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
It's phenomenal.
Well, for tracking pink slips, deeds,
everything.
And wills, and everything else that's out there, it's all going to be secure, authenticated, and on a ledger with a whole track record of how you got from here to there.
Yeah.
That's pretty phenomenal, and it will... a buddy of mine, Bill Reduschel, who's one of the smartest guys I know, he said it feels to him like TCP/IP back in the
it's infrastructure
in the late 80s, and what TCP/IP did to the world, this is going to be transactional IP, enabling IP that we just haven't had before.
The trust protocol, as they call it. Yeah.
Are you a book reader? Do you read books?
Or? You know, I don't have time, so I'm a Twitter reader. So I spend a lot of time reading long articles that I find on. But if you can't explain it to me in two or three pages, I find that maybe I'm shallow, but or simple. But you know, if it isn't that fundamentally obvious after a few pages, then you can't. You know, sorry for the length of this letter. I didn't have time to make it short. You know,
Mark Twain. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I firmly believe that, and I'm smart enough to get the general idea very quickly. So I do cliff notes.
Okay. Yeah.
So read my Twitter feed. That's the best one. And by the way, I'm trying to stay ahead of my oldest son because, you know, if he wins a tournament, he's going to blow right by me on Twitter followers.
Oh boy, it's at Scott McNeely.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, this has been awesome. It's just been a great honor to have you here, actually. Yeah. You made our podcast real, I think, by being here. So thank you so much.
Appreciate it. It was fun. I enjoyed it.
Good. People do. That's really tremendous.
I'm probably going to get a lot of roasting on Twitter, but I'm okay with that.
Now, well, are you going to let Scott listen to it before we post it? Does he get a screening right?
No.
I'm going to make you look really good. We're going to make all of us look great. So no worries on that end. Thank you very much.
I'm Tom O'Malley. I'm drinking wine.
This is Jonathan Reichenthal, and I'm Talking Tech.
Thanks again. Take care, guys.